This is the NCARB podcast, where you get an inside look at licensure, regulation, and the initiatives shaping the future of architectural practice. I'm your host, Andy McIntyre, Vice President of Marketing and Communications at NCARB. And this season, we're diving into Pathways to Practice, NCARB's multi-year effort to rethink how architects become licensed.
Architecture is the hardware to the software of life, right? It is fundamentally about that interaction, and it makes life easier if we have a built environment that works.
Across 8 episodes, we'll explore how licensure got to where it is today and where it needs to go next. We talk with architects, educators, regulators, and NCARB leaders about education, experience, and the exam, and why each of those pillars is evolving.
And that portion of school where you go from conceptual to real is also really challenging. It's not something you're really gently moved into. It's kind of like you're doing something that's flowy and crazy, and all of a sudden, wait, you actually have to make this work.
You'll hear how the NCARB competency standard was developed, how research is shaping future licensure models, and what a more flexible, competency-based approach could mean for candidates from a wide range of backgrounds.
So we've seen that in our data as the number of reciprocal licenses starts to decrease a little bit, but that number of individuals who are licensed holds steady.
We also tackle the big questions. Why does licensure look the way it does today? Where do candidates face the biggest barriers? And how can we expand access without lowering standards?
Not everybody fits into the same mold. And so having different pathways to licensure, I think, is really important.
Whether you're a licensure candidate, an educator, a firm leader, or a regulator, this season offers clarity, context, and transparency into one of the most important conversations facing the profession.
Does this requirement to complete all divisions of the exam place an unfair burden on any one group or other?
This is Pathways to Practice, only on the NCARB podcast. Please follow the link in the show notes, subscribe now, and join us as we explore the future of architectural licensure.
Wait, pause. It's not a statue like of her person. Does that change how you're answering this question?
Yeah, what the frick? What is it a statue of?
It's a sculpture, like as a monument to her. It's like artistic.
Delete this whole thing.
Hello. And welcome back to She Builds Podcast, where we share stories about women in the design and construction field, one lady at a time. This season's theme is Places We've Called Home. That means we're sharing stories of ladies who are from or lived anywhere that we have lived for any period of time or considered a home. On today's episode, we'll be talking about Jacoba Mulder, a Dutch architect and urban planner. I'm Lizzie Rahr, craving some banquette or amandelstoff in San Francisco. And I'm joined by my fellow co-hosts, Jessica and Nergiti.
I'm Nergiti Rivas, Sausai Su Broja in Houston, Texas.
And I'm Jessica Rogers, wishing I had some stroop waffles with my coffee based out of Miami, Florida.
That sounds great.
Good stuff.
It's time for our disclaimer. The three of us are passionate about what we're doing, but we are not experts on this subject. We are just sharing stories about the women and the information that we find. If we get our facts a little mixed up, please forgive us. Leave us a comment and we will all continue learning.
Okay, ladies. Today we're going back to Europe, specifically naar Nederland. So, before we talk about Jacoba, I will tell you why I have chosen her. All right? Are you ready?
Okay. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Okay. So after we graduated from Syracuse, I got an internship at a firm in The Hague in the Netherlands, and I lived in the Marlott area of Den Haag for 3.5 months. I really loved living in the Netherlands, and I loved all the biking, the trains, the style of the homes and the buildings, and the stroopwafels, the croquette, all the things. Just loved it all.
I was in the Netherlands with you for 3 days, and I really enjoyed it, so I can see why you liked it too. And we got to celebrate Queen's Day, which is a big national holiday. It should be on everyone's bucket list, even though it's called King's Day now. But The architecture and the pedestrian-friendly city design are huge draws for me. I can't wait to visit again. I'm really excited to learn more about Jacoba.
Yes. And Lizzie, that internship sounded so exciting and so cool. So I'm excited that we're going international again. And we're going to talk about Naar Nederland, however you said it.
About Nederland?
Nederland. I never heard of it that way. But I mean, that's
how you say it in Dutch.
Yeah. Natural language.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, another reason that I'm excited to talk about another Dutch lady is that my family roots are in the Netherlands on my dad's side. His grandparents were all born in the Netherlands and emigrated to the US when they were kids in the early 20th century. So you might have caught in episode 73 that I grew up in Holland, Michigan. So needless to say, there's a lot of Dutchies over in West Michigan. So I still have some distant family in the Netherlands that Nergity and I stayed with when we were studying in Florence. That's the 3 days she mentioned.
Right. That was the 3 days in the Netherlands that I was talking about. Shout out to De Vries that thought it was hilarious that I didn't eat soft boiled eggs on a little egg stand thing that they had. Do you remember that, Lizzie? What was the name of that little stand?
It's called an egg cup. I think you hadn't had a soft boiled egg before or like eaten it plain like that because you have to put it. It's too soft in the middle. So you have to have like a little cup to hold it so that you can like, you know, eat the runny yolk.
Jessica looks as confused as me. Right?
Well, I don't eat eggs in general. I think I've seen that.
Well, true.
I've never seen that until I was there.
Yeah, but it's very common there. And I think in Germany, too. But
no, lessons learned.
Anyway, laten we beginnen. Welkom in Breda, Nederland. Jacoba Mulder was born on March 2nd, 1900. Fun fact, I've actually been to Breda, not for very long, but I did set foot in the city. So Breda is in the southern part of the Netherlands near the border with Belgium between Rotterdam and Antwerp.
Cool. What were you up to there?
I was there taking pictures of a building for my job. Nothing super exciting, but
okay, cool.
Still cool.
Yeah, you were there.
You were there. Yeah. Just the whole thing.
Yeah.
She's so modest. Like, oh.
Well, you know. Working. So most people called Jacoba Co. So we'll use the two names interchangeably in the episode. Her parents were Hendrik Mulder, an infantry officer, and Sara Marie Boon. So we talked about Breda, but even though Ko was born there, her family soon moved to Semarang, Indonesia, on the island of Java.
Oh, well, that was quick. We've been traveling on this episode.
Yep. And it's interesting, like, what would bring them to Indonesia?
Right. So her dad was an officer in the Royal Dutch East Indies Army. So they were stationed in Indonesia, which at that time was a colony of the Netherlands. Semarang is in central Java, and it's not too far from Borobudur Temple, which you ladies might remember from architectural history class? Question mark.
It looks familiar, but I don't remember it too much. It is stunning, though. I'd go visit if I live close to it. I hope that Ko got to go.
Ooh, yes. I forgot that I was in Indonesia, but I do recall this building or this temple because it's considered to be the world's largest Buddhist monument. And like you said, Nergity, this building, it's impressive. It's stunning. It's huge.
Yeah, it's definitely something that's always been on my bucket list since we learned about it in school. Mm-hmm. So, and the temple apparently made a big impression on Ko as a child. So sadly, though, Ko got malaria a lot as a kid. So when she was 13, she and her younger sister went back to the Netherlands and her parents stayed in Indonesia and eventually they separated.
What just happened? Okay, wait, let's take this by parts. This is going to be really ignorant, but I didn't know that you could get malaria more than once. I thought that it was one of those things that either kill you or you build immunity to it. Like a more lethal chicken pox or something like that. But I'm guessing now that I'm thinking about it, it comes from getting mosquito bites, right?
Yeah.
So it's more like dengue. Okay. I get it now.
I mean, I'm sure it happens more than once, but I don't think I've heard of people getting it multiple times. Yeah, I mean, from what I've seen, it's definitely treatable and it can be lethal if it's untreated.
Mm. So, okay, that makes sense. So she just had bad luck.
A little bit. She also has mosquito blood. Like, I get mosquito bites all the time. Luckily, I live in an area where I wouldn't get malaria, but...
But then the kids left without the parents? Like, who did they stay with? And the parents separated? I just feel like a lot of things happened.
Yeah.
Lizzie, that was a lot.
That was a lot. And that was the part that confused me and was sad. Like, Lizzie, where did her and her sister stay? Like, because their parents weren't with them.
I know. So... At first, Ko and her sister, they went to live with family in Lara, which Nurjiri is one town over from Bussum.
OMG, Bussum! Such a fun name to say. But you know what's more fun? Nardum Bussum. I loved getting on the train and going to Nardum Bussum. It's real close to Amsterdam, too. Just a little train ride away.
Yes, exactly. When Ko was in high school, she went to live on her own with, quote, private individuals in Assa, which is way in the north in Drenthe. I assume that she was going to a school up there and didn't find specific information on which one. But I wonder if private individuals means like she boarded with a local family that lived close to the school, or they provided housing for the students. It was unclear.
That sounds real sketchy, Lizzie.
I know.
Wonder if something got lost in translation. Like, were you Googling translating this?
I don't remember.
I just, private individuals. Like, I wonder how that would fly with my mama. They'd be like, private individuals. Private individuals.
But that's why I think it's got to be something about the translation.
Probably. Hopefully that's what it is. But it does remind me of like, OK, I was watching this movie and this girl goes to a private school and there's benefactors of the school that have these huge mansions and they would like offer housing for students. So it was kind of like a boarding house.
Right.
So private individuals means to me that maybe they could have been like very important and rich, that they didn't want their business out there. They just wanted to help.
Or like how it was in Florence for us, right? That like families offered to have people stay with them and they got like a stipend for providing housing for someone at the school nearby. That's kind of what I thought maybe it meant.
Yeah. But it still sounds sketchy.
Yeah, but it's a weird phrasing, which I think, yeah, probably a translation issue. Mm-hmm. In 1918, when Ko is 18, she graduates high school and decides that she wants to study architecture at Technische Hogeschool Delft, the Technical College of Delft. Today, it is Technische Universiteit Delft, or Delft University of Technology, also called TU Delft.
Oh, TU Delft! That is a great school in the Netherlands. And not just the Netherlands, it's renowned all through Europe.
Yeah. Yes, it's really impressive. And like Najdi said, this school, it's one of the greats in the world to this day.
Yes. I think we've talked before about how I thought about doing structural engineering for a master's degree after college. And I actually looked into TU Delft. I didn't pursue anything, but I was like intrigued of the idea of like, what if I go to Europe and study structural engineering?
That would have been interesting. It's never too late, Lizzie.
Yes. You never know.
You never know. You still have a shot. I know that. I mean, you've definitely mentioned studying structural engineering if you were to get your master's, because we've definitely talked about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you, I mean, TU Delft, that would be cool too. Go back to your roots. I know.
Well, Ko was one of the first ladies to attend TU Delft. I did not find out like what number she was, but definitely one of the first. I'm also a bit confused on the exact degree she got. Most say she went there to study architecture, but a few places say she graduated with a civil engineering degree and some say urban design degree. One says she got a civil engineering degree with a specialization in urban design, which apparently was a new program at TU Delft. All that is to say, she was an early woman in the school and this area of study. and she graduated in 1926.
Okay, congratulations, Co, for your degree on something and your achievement on being a pioneer at that something. Good job.
I mean, it's still amazing, though.
It is.
Yeah.
Even if we don't know what it is. Exactly.
Right, right. I mean, it was engineering or architecture, but like they're all kind of, you know, in the same vein. So that same year she graduated, she won a competition for the design of a fire station. The competition was put on by the Vereniging Baukunst en Vriendschap in Rotterdam, which literally translates to the Association of Architecture and Friendship.
Oh, that's great. Winning competitions, putting her name on the map. And what a great name for an association. Sounds super cute. I join.
Right?
Yeah. It's also really cool that it's a fire station, like of all things.
Mm-hmm. Well, she submitted her design anonymously or under like just her last name. And they said the winning design had a, quote, masculine toughness to it. Little did they know.
This is excellent. I love that Co is like beating the system. Ooh, yeah. I wonder what the look on their faces were when they found out that the designer of this masculine toughness was a woman.
That's right.
I know. That's I wish her. I could have seen the faces. She did have a tough time finding work, though, and apparently one of the jobs turned her down because, quote, it is difficult for women to be sent out onto the scaffolding.
Man, these ridiculous hurdles they come up with, like, seriously.
Right? Seriously, like, for real. Like, how is it difficult for a woman? Like, how? Like,
her skirts might get caught up in them, you know?
I don't know. It's just, and why?
It's ridiculous.
Like, it's ridiculous. And I know that we've heard countless excuses that men have come up with so that women wouldn't practice, but it's still so frustrating. Like, why?
I know. She did eventually get a job at Gerritsen en Wegerif architectural firm in The Hague as a draftsperson. But then in 1928, she got a job at the city of Delft. She was hired as an adjunct engineer for the Zuid-Holland West Regional Development Plan.
Gefeliciteerd.
Okay. So now I'm wondering that Co graduated with either multiple degrees or maybe an architecture degree with a concentration in engineering or like vice versa. Because how do you go from being a draftsperson of an architecture firm to an adjunct engineer? But anyway, the project sounds big and sustainable. Like, I'm just happy she got work, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, the title is engineer, but I think she's working on urban plan stuff.
Oh, okay.
So I think that goes back to like the urban design specialization that she did in college. Yeah. Well, she worked there for a few years helping with this expansion project. And then in 1930, she applied to work at the city of Amsterdam's new Stadsontwikkeling, or Urban Development Department. This is a brand new department within the city's Public Works Department.
I like this urban planning route that she's been taking.
Mm-hmm. So since she had experience working in Delft, she got the job. She was one of the few people who had experience in urban planning. And to top it off, she quickly moved up to be the second in command at the department under Cornelius van Eesteren.
Ooh, that's very cool. Okay, so let's talk about Cornelius a little bit. Or how do you say Cornelius? I don't know.
Cornelius.
Cornelius. So he served as president of CIAM, the Congrès International de Architecture Moderne, which, listeners, you might recognize this whenever we've mentioned Corbusier, because he's always been like the more well-known member of CIAM. I think Charlotte Perriand, episode 42, was a part of it. And I know that we've talked about it then. But what makes Cornelius, I'm going to butcher this man's name, Cornelius, what makes him cool is that he is actually one of the founders of the De Stijl movement, a favorite of ours that we've talked about.
Yes. Woo!
But he is also most known for his urban planning. So it's actually kind of cool that Co is like second in command and works so closely with this guy.
I'm so impressed.
Yeah. So he's very well known for doing kind of this urban planning expansion of Amsterdam. But you will soon see that Co is very much part of that. So
okay.
Oh. When we're talking about Cornelius, we're also and Amsterdam, we're talking about Co. So
bam.
So at first, she's an associate and worked with Van Esteren and Theodor K. van Lohause on the General Expansion Plan, or AUP, for the city. So that was the expansion plan for Amsterdam that Cornelius had come up with. The two men were working on the urban expansion outlines of the project, and Co would elaborate the designs. Co had 30 draftsmen working under her, all men. And here's a translated quote from someone who interviewed her. She had no problem with that herself. She immediately introduced herself and never tutored. Just be an expert, then you will automatically get respect, was her conviction.
Like a boss.
This is like the boss way of saying fake it till you make it. I like it though.
So one of the biggest items in this AUP that Jacoba is credited with is Het Amsterdamse Bos, or the Amsterdam Forest. So the park is 2,500 acres, which for reference is about three times larger than Central Park in New York City. It's located both in Amstelveen and Amsterdam, but it's owned by the city of Amsterdam.
Oh my gosh, that's huge.
No, like really huge though.
Mm-hmm. So the history of the park is that back in 1900, the Dutch biologist, Dr. J.P. Thijssen, wanted to create a green space for the city because they were lacking in those. He was working on the Public Works Committee, and finally, in 1928, the city decided to move forward on this project. Also, in 1930, we're right at the start of the Great Depression, so unemployment is very high in the Netherlands. In Amsterdam, they estimated that 55,000 people were unemployed at this time. They decided to use the construction of this new park as a work relief program. And it's estimated that between 1934 and 1940, the project provided work for more than 20,000 unemployed citizens.
I often forget that the Great Depression affected countries in Europe as much as it did the United States. But it's interesting and nice to hear the good Jacoba's work did, and for so many years, to society overall, not just creating important spaces for the future, but even in the immediate present, creating jobs and helping so many families. Like, how impactful is that?
Yes, for sure.
So Co is leading the design of this park. And she decides to use English gardens as her inspiration instead of the more manicured European gardens. She worked with a formula of one-third forest, one-third open space, and one-third water. The result is a more natural-looking park with areas that are also more functional for recreation, sports, and play.
I'm liking this formula. I can't wait to plan our Netherlands art venture and play in these parks.
Yes! I also like this distinction between the English gardens versus the other like manicured European gardens. I need to see photos.
Yes. So working on the Bos plan gained her notoriety with the people of the city, and she became known as the Lady of the Forest.
The what? I'm not sure how I feel about that nickname. Is that a compliment?
Yeah. It was like a loving nickname that they were like, oh, she's the Lady of the Forest because she like designed the park.
Sounds mystical.
I guess lady is respectful. But my first thought was Kaya from Where the Crawdads Sing being called Marsh Girl, and how that was not a compliment at all.
Well, no. It's not. Well, Lady of the Forest is better than Beatrix Ferran's nickname when they called her Bushwoman.
Yes, exactly.
I totally erased that from my memory. That's hilarious.
Yeah. And of course, like I'm translating it from Dutch, right? So it's like Dama. That's the lady. Mm-hmm. So
I mean, she classy. She a lady.
Or it could be, I guess you could maybe translate it as the woman of the forest. But so still, anyway.
Okay.
Yeah. Better than Bushwoman.
The project was started in 1930 and it was originally set to be finished in 1948. But World War II had other plans. So it did eventually get finished, but the last tree was not planted until 1970.
I mean, it makes sense, especially considering that there was a whole war going on, but also just the size of the park. It was going to take time.
Yeah, it's huge.
It's huge.
In 1936, she started working on her next park design, Beatrix Park. The AUP had planned for a new park in Amsterdam Zuid, or South Amsterdam, called Park Zuid. She used a similar design strategy and created a mix of water features and open spaces. When the park was completed in 1938, it was named Beatrix Park after the newly born Princess Beatrix, who was the queen when we went to Queen's Day, Nergity.
Oh, that's so lovely and how it's all coming together. We're so connected.
It's really cute.
In 2018, artists Liet Heringer and Martin van Kaelsbeek created a sculpture as a monument to Co, which sits in Beatrix Park. It's called Future Past Glory.
What? We need to have pictures of that on our show notes. I love hearing about this, women's sculptures, but also, can we get a statue? Did you know that statistically, there are far fewer statues of real women, not mermaids or goddesses. I'm talking statues commemorating real women that lived on planet Earth. Those are real scarce. For example, in the United States, there's less than 10% statues commemorating women. So this is my PSA. Here's to hoping that number grows and that there are statues of us made one day for our great contributions for the future generations to learn about us. Hashtag modest surgery. Hashtag I want a statue.
Okay. I think I would say maybe like a plaque or something, or I don't know about.
No, math. We need statues, Jessica.
Sure. I guess, but out of the 10% of statues in the U.S., we do know of one of our ladies, Frances Perkins. She is in front of the building of labor secretary because she was the cabinet member in D.C. So it's still cool, though, that they're honoring Co, even if it's not of a face. It's all representative, I guess. But I don't know, Nojiri. I don't know if I'd want a statue of myself somewhere.
Okay, fine. We don't need statues of us, but we need more ladies, more women's statues. Yes.
It doesn't have to be us, but of others.
I agree with that. Okay, so World War II happens, which puts a stop to most of the work that Co and Cornelius are doing. So our story picks up after World War II during the Netherlands Reconstruction era. We've been talking a lot about the AUP, right? But most of it wasn't truly implemented until after World War II, because that put a wrench in their plans, right? That makes sense also because lots of people are returning after the war, right? A lot of the city had been destroyed and there was a big baby boom on the rise, right?
Mm. Yeah.
So there's a need for a lot of buildings and an increase in housing. Amsterdam would essentially double in size during this time under the AUP.
Oh, yes. Okay. So we've mentioned this before when we've talked about the Eames and how that kind of brought about the case study houses, or even talking about Florence Knoll, the rise in housing after the war back in the States. So I can only imagine that it was more of a necessity in Europe.
Yeah. So places like Slotermeer, Roosevelt, Slotervaart, Overtoomse Veld and Oostdorp all started out on Co's desk with her team. And those are all neighborhoods in Amsterdam. So originally in Van Eesteren's master plan for the city expansion, he had planned for strip housing on parallel blocks. And they had implemented this in Bossenlommer before the war. After the war, they're working on the plan for Frankendal, for the Frankendal neighborhood in the south of the city. And it was originally planned in this same way as Bossenlommer, strip housing. However, the method was thought to be monotonous after seeing it built in Bossenlommer. Actually, CM kind of made comments about it.
Mm.
And so Jacoba was put in charge of redesigning the plan And she created an L-shaped arrangement of these housing blocks so that it created a courtyard between the apartment buildings. This way, it brought more light into the units and allowed for more green space in between them.
How smart.
Mm-hmm.
So this new plan was called the Frankendal Plan, and it was implemented in most of the westward expansion in Amsterdam. It's actually really cool because if you go on Google Maps and look at a lot of those neighborhoods that I mentioned, you can actually see that they're L-shaped. Like you can see it from the street configuration and that kind of thing. You'll see blocks of these little L-shapes.
Mm-hmm. On my way to Google Maps to check this out right now.
Mm-hmm. I think I've seen it before. This is cool.
Yeah. One of the other reasons that the Frankendal plan was great in Co's mind was that she would put a playground in each of the courtyards and then mothers could watch their kids from the kitchen window. Co had a huge heart for playgrounds, which brings us to the next part of our story.
Next part? There's more than one part?
Indeed.
Oh, okay. Part two.
Well, one day in 1947... Co was heading to work from her apartment in Bertelmannplein, and she said, "I saw this girl from the neighborhood busy with a shovel digging near a tree. Nice sand came up. She used it for baking tarts with. But then, alas, a dog came by and did his duty, and that was the end of that."
Ew. For a second, I thought this was going to be like this aspirational story about like creativity and stuff. This little girl, like, ew.
That took a turn.
Took a brown turn.
Well, that's sort of the point, though.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Co is like, this girl needs a good place to play, right? So she goes into the office that same day, and she says that they need to start creating playgrounds in the city. And that, quote, "things are different for children from 10 and above. They need more space." Again, remember, this is right after World War II, so babies are booming. Kids are all over the city. And in 1947, there are fewer than 30 playgrounds in the city of Amsterdam.
Oh, yeah. Them baby boomers need a place to play.
And a place that is safe without dog stuff.
So that day, Aldo van Eyck happened to be in the office when Co came in with this idea, and he volunteered to design it. So this is how the playground at Bertelmannplein was born.
Oh man, this is awesome. Okay, so Aldo van Eyck was a Dutch architect. Listeners, if you've ever looked at structuralist architecture, you most likely would have seen his work because that's what he's best known for in terms of architecture. His work literally looks like Lego blocks, like together. It's really cool to look at. And it also makes sense that Giacoa and Aldo would want to work together because Aldo was interested in creating places that brought in community life for children. So it's, I see the connection. Seems like it would be a good partnership.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, Aldo van Eyck, we think of him with playground design a lot of times.
Yeah.
And part of that is started because of this, because of Jacoba, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
that's so cool.
The cool thing was that after this playground was built, a neighbor saw it and wrote to the public works department saying, "Hey, can we have a playground a few blocks over here?" Mm-hmm. So they built one over there. And then another request came in and another, and by 1968, there were over 1,000 playgrounds in the city. That's 50 playgrounds every year between 1947 and 1968. And all of them were overseen by Cornelius and Jacoba and designed by Aldo.
Oh, goodness. I'm really enjoying all these requests coming in and so fast.
Right?
She does so good. Like a playground boom.
I love it. A playground boom for the baby boomers. Also, I like the idea that, like, we're starting our story with her not getting work to now she's getting all the work. I love it.
That's right.
Yeah.
This was such a great instance of community buy-in to urban planning, right? Most of the playgrounds were requested from citizens, and many of them were designed in specific places that were suggested and designed in response to a specific request by that citizen or group of citizens. So they were almost made to order in a way.
Oh,
this is great. It's like for the people, by the people, to give to the people. It's like customization, but like for large groups of people.
Yeah, exactly. So this way of designing was described as bottom-up design, right? With it coming from the citizens and children in contrast with a top-down method like CM promoted and the overall AUP than Van Aesteren designed for Amsterdam. And Co was a proponent of the bottom-up design.
Co was literally turning that concept on its head. Like,
yeah. It's or great. Kind of working them together, right? You know, like it shouldn't just come top-down. It should also be bottom-up.
Yeah, sometimes it's not always black and white. There's always a little bit of gray in there.
You got to get it shaken, not stirred.
Exactly.
So in 1952, Co was made the chief architect of Amsterdam, and Van Aesteren became the head of the urban development department. And Van Aesteren became the head of the urban development department. Then in 1958, when Cornelius retired, Co took his place as the head of the department. The duo was instrumental in the growth and expansion of Amsterdam in the 20th century. The population grew from 7,500,000 in 1930 to almost a million at the end of the 20th century.
That lady has the green thumb of urban design. Everything she touches grows. Look at her becoming chief architect. Such a fancy role.
Yes. Okay, so this could have been an interesting partnerships episode, like her partnership with Cornelius and Aldo. I also love that when Cornelius steps down, Co was the one that takes his place, and they didn't just give it, they didn't give this role to like another man, which we've also seen.
Right. Yeah, but they were clearly like a good working duo, and, you know, she was respected in the department.
Yes.
As the head of the department, she continued to work on the urban planning expansion of Amsterdam and was closely involved in the design of Buitenwagert and oversaw the development for Molenwijk in Amsterdam Noord. She believed that there should be a mix of high-rise, medium-rise, and low-rise buildings to keep variety and avoid monotony.
Elementary, my dear Watson.
Well, in the 60s, she got into it a little bit with Siegfried Nasseth. He was the architect who designed the Bijlmermeer project, often referred to just as Bijlmer. It's a neighborhood in the southeast of Amsterdam, and the project proposed lots of identical high-rise buildings laid out in a hexagonal grid. It does sound like the project was trying to create green spaces between the buildings from what I looked at, and sunlight coming in and all of that, but Co really didn't like the design. She thought that the human dimension had been lost. And apparently she came up with an alternative design, but there was pressure from politicians and developers, and it was built as originally designed by Siegfried. Mm.
Well, from briefly looking this project up, I can see her point a little bit. I mean, it's massive, the scale of it. Yet it does look like an interesting piece of architecture. I don't think I have the same beef with it like she does. I'm okay with it.
Well, to her earlier point, though, this project, it looking at it, it's very monotonous in design. It seems a little redundant in this like shape that just keeps repeating itself. I mean, it doesn't look bad, but maybe it could have been done better.
So. Yeah. And what's interesting is actually maybe half the buildings, it sounds like, have been torn down since then. And they're creating kind of different they're creating more variety in the types of buildings and that kind of thing.
I would love to cheer was with Jacoba. Like, I could just imagine like we're at a pub being like, yeah, turn that down. Yeah.
Well, in 1965, Co retired from the Urban Development Department. During her retirement, she was a lecturer in planning at the University of Amsterdam until she was 70.
Yeah, spread that knowledge to future generations, Co.
As always with our ladies, retired, but not retired. They're still working. But you know what? I wouldn't mind taking a class from her, though. I feel like I'd enjoy her class.
Not at all. Yeah, I wouldn't mind at all.
Jacoba passed away on November 5th, 1988, at 88 years old.
Man, what a legacy she left. Such great work that was beneficial for the communities on so many levels and touched so many lives. Great work, Jacoba.
Yes, her work was so impactful for the city of Amsterdam.
So before we leave you, we have to tell you who our caryatid is for this week's episode. Jessica, can you remind us what a caryatid is?
Yeah. All right, for some background, a caryatid is a stone carving of a woman used as a column or pillar to support the structure of a Greek or Greek-style building. In each episode, we'll choose a caryatid, a woman who is working today, furthering profession, doing her thing with her work, and who ties into the historical woman of our episode.
So without further ado, this week's caryatid is... Linda Flasselhold. Linda. So Linda is a curator and program manager on urban planning. She studied architectural history at the University of Amsterdam, and she was the chief curator at the Netherlands Architecture Institute from 2000 to 2011. She's also a core member of Stad Forum, an independent research organization that advises the city of Amsterdam on urban development.
That's amazing, Linda.
Yes, I can already see the connection to code too.
Yes. In 2011, she founded Studio Linda Flasselrode. According to her website, Linda's goal is to involve a broader group than just insiders in the development of cities, and her approach is interdisciplinary. She facilitates discussion of complex urban issues in stimulating ways, organizes multi-year and shorter programs for cultural institutions, municipalities, and commercial entities.
Ooh, very cool.
So one of the other reasons that I chose Linda today is that one of her research projects is actually on Jacoba Mulder. She's working on a book about her, which I really cannot wait to read.
Ooh. If this is not a connection, I don't know what is. We may have to revisit this episode once the book comes out. That's really exciting.
For sure.
Yes. Y'all, how cool would it be if we could interview her? Mm-hmm. Like, both ladies sound so cool, and I can't wait to get my hands on this book. I just hope that it's in English.
Yes, I know.
Both languages, at least.
Right, right.
Yes, yes.
I'm very excited about it. There's not a lot about Jacoba because she was very modest. And so I'm excited to read more about the research that Linda finds about her.
Yeah.
Woo.
Oh, so cool.
Okay. Before we say tot ziens, we want to say dankje to CMYK for the music, John W., our technical producer, and most of all, danke wel for listening. We hope you enjoyed learning about Jacoba and Linda along with our banter, and that you're inspired to find out more about them and other amazing professional ladies. Again, danke wel.
Shebuilds Podcast is a member of Gable Media Podcast Network, and Gable Media is all about building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com.
Please let us know what you thought of our episode. If you enjoyed it, please help us spread the word. Tell your friends, your Dutch speakers, your people from Michigan that are Dutch, your playground goers, your people that eat pigs in blankets and banquette. tell them to give us 5 stars on iTunes. Tell them to write us a review and compliment Lizzie's amazing Dutch pronunciations, and help us spread the word to a wider audience and for more people to learn about these amazing ladies with us.
We are excited to hear from you and for you to come back and keep learning about women bosses with us. You can email us your thoughts at shebuildspodcast@gmail.com. Leave a comment on our website, shebuildspodcast.com, or follow us on Instagram and Facebook at shebuildspodcast and on Twitter at shebuildspod. Until next time, tot ziens!
Tot ziens!
Jessica, can you remind us what a caryatid is?
Da.
Yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, sorry.
Da is Russian.
Oh, yeah.
Hey there, architecture enthusiast. Nikita Reed here, inviting you on an incredible journey through time and space with my podcast, Tangible Remnants. Historic preservation and sustainability? Let's go ahead right now and debunk the myth that they are opposites. In fact, they are two sides of the same coin shaping our collective future.
In a work environment, it has been challenging because I've had to probably do more than double just to make sure that I quote unquote fit in. But the environments that have allowed me to do me on the front end, I've been extremely successful.
You look at all these PhDs, they've built that on the backs of our elders.
Absolutely.
What they consider themselves to be experts at is what they've worked with us to achieve.
I know we have to prioritize people before products and before place.
Join me as we unravel the stories of historic buildings shaped by the people of a specific era and often influenced by race and gender. These tangible remnants are windows into our past and guideposts for the future. Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe now to Tangible Remnants. Let's explore the interconnectedness of architecture, preservation, sustainability, race, and gender.